Chapter 36. Comprising a brief description of the company at the Peacock assembled, and a tale told by a bagman, it is pleasant to turn from contemplating the strife and turmoil of political existence, to the peaceful repose of private life. Although in reality no great partisan of either side, Mr. Pickwick was sufficiently fired with Mr. Poet's enthusiasm to apply his whole time and attention to the proceedings, of which the last chapter affords a description compiled from his own memoranda. Nor while he was thus occupied was Mr. Winkle idle, his whole time being devoted to pleasant walks and short country excursions with Mrs. Poet, who never failed, when such an opportunity presented itself, to seek some relief from the tedious monotony she so constantly complained of. The two gentlemen being thus completely domesticated in the editor's house, Mr. Tupman and Mr. Snodgrass were in a great measure cast upon their own resources. Taking but little interest in public affairs, they beguiled their time chiefly with such amusements as the Peacock afforded, which were limited to a bagatelle board in the first floor, and a sequestered skittle ground in the backyard. In the science and nicety of both these recreations, which are far more abstruse than ordinary men suppose, they were gradually initiated by Mr. Weller, who possessed a perfect knowledge of such pastimes. Thus, notwithstanding that they were in a great measure deprived of the comfort and advantage of Mr. Pickwick's society, they were still enabled to beguile the time, and to prevent its hanging heavily on their hands. It was in the evening, however, that the Peacock presented attractions which enabled the two friends to resist even the invitations of the gifted, though prosy, poet. It was in the evening that the commercial room was filled with a social circle, whose characters and manners it was the delight of Mr. Tupman to observe, whose sayings and doings it was the habit of Mr. Snodgrass to note down. Most people know what sort of places commercial rooms usually are. That of the Peacock differed in no material respect from the generality of such apartments. That is to say, it was a large, bare-looking room, the furniture of which had no doubt been better when it was newer, with a spacious table in the center, and a variety of smaller dittos in the corners, an extensive assortment of variously shaped chairs, and an old Turkey carpet, bearing about the same relative proportion to the size of the room as a lady's pocket handkerchief might to the floor of a watch box. The walls were garnished with one or two large maps, and several weather-beaten rough greatcoats, with complicated capes, dangled from a long row of pegs in one corner. The mantel shelf was ornamented with a wooden inkstand, containing one stump of a pen and half a wafer, a road book and directory, a county history minus the cover, and the mortal remains of a trout in a glass coffin. The atmosphere was redolent of tobacco smoke, the fumes of which had communicated a rather dingy hue to the whole room, and more especially to the moldy red curtains which shaded the windows. On the sideboard a variety of miscellaneous articles were huddled together, the most conspicuous of which were some very cloudy fish sauce cruets, a couple of driving boxes, two or three whips, and as many traveling shawls, a tray of knives and forks, and the mustard. Here it was that Mr. Tupman and Mr. Snodgrass were seated on the evening after the conclusion of the election, with several other temporary inmates of the house, smoking and drinking. "Well, gents," apostrophe said a stout, hale personage of about 40, with only one eye, a very bright black eye, which twinkled with a roguish expression of fun and good humor, "our noble selves, gents. I always propose that toast to the company, and drink merry to myself. Eh, merry. Apostrophe, get along with you, you wretch," apostrophe said the handmaiden, obviously not ill-pleased with the compliment, however. "Don't go away, merry," apostrophe said the black-eyed man. "Let me alone, imperence," apostrophe said the young lady. "Never mind," apostrophe said the one-eyed man, calling after the girl as she left the room. "I'll step out by and by, Mary. Keep your spirits up, dear. Apostrophe here, he went through the not very difficult process of winking upon the company with his solitary eye, to the enthusiastic delight of an elderly personage with a dirty face and a clay pipe. Rum creeters is women, apostrophe said the dirty-faced man, after a pause. Ah! No mistake about that, apostrophe said a very red-faced man, behind a cigar. After this little bit of philosophy there was another pause. There's rummer things than women in this world though, mind you, apostrophe said the man with the black eye, slowly filling a large Dutch pipe, with a most capacious bowl. Are you married? Apostrophe inquired the dirty-faced man. Can't say I am. Apostrophe, I thought not. Apostrophe here the dirty-faced man fell into ecstasies of mirth at his own retort, in which he was joined by a man of bland voice and placid countenance, who always made it a point to agree with everybody. Women, after all, gentlemen, apostrophe said the enthusiastic Mr. Snodgrass, are the great props and comforts of our existence. Apostrophe, so they are, apostrophe said the placid gentleman. When they are in a good humor, apostrophe interposed the dirty-faced man. And that's very true, apostrophe said the placid one. I repudiate that qualification, apostrophe said Mr. Snodgrass, whose thoughts were fast reverting to Emily Wardle. I repudiate it with disdain, with indignation. Show me the man who says anything against women, as women, and I boldly declare he is not a man. Apostrophe and Mr. Snodgrass took his cigar from his mouth, and struck the table violently with his clenched fist. That's good sound argument, apostrophe said the placid man. Containing a position which I deny, apostrophe interrupted he of the dirty countenance. And there's certainly a very great deal of truth in what you observe too, sir, apostrophe said the placid gentleman. Your health, sir, apostrophe said the bagman with the lonely eye, bestowing an approving nod on Mr. Snodgrass. Mr. Snodgrass acknowledged the compliment. I always like to hear a good argument, apostrophe continued the bagman, a sharp one, like this. It's very improving, but this little argument about women brought to my mind a story I have heard an old uncle of mine tell, the recollection of which, just now, made me say there were rummer things than women to be met with, sometimes. Apostrophe, I should like to hear that same story, apostrophe said the red-faced man with the cigar. Should you? Apostrophe was the only reply of the bagman, who continued to smoke with great vehemence. So should I, apostrophe said Mr. Tubman, speaking for the first time. He was always anxious to increase his stock of experience. Should you? Well then, I'll tell it. No, I won't. I know you won't believe it, apostrophe said the man with the roguish eye, making that organ look more roguish than ever. If you say it's true, of course I shall, apostrophe said Mr. Tubman. Well, upon that understanding I'll tell you, apostrophe replied the traveler. Did you ever hear of the great commercial house of Bilson and Slum? But it doesn't matter though, whether you did or not, because they retired from business long since. It's 80 years ago, since the circumstance happened to a traveler for that house, but he was a particular friend of my uncle's, and my uncle told the story to me. It's a queer name, but he used to call it, the Bagman's Story, and he used to tell it, something in this way. One winter's evening, about 5 o'clock, just as it began to grow dusk, a man in a gig might have been seen urging his tired horse along the road which leads across Marlborough Downs, in the direction of Bristol. I say he might have been seen, and I have no doubt he would have been, if anybody but a blind man had happened to pass that way, but the weather was so bad, and the night so cold and wet, that nothing was out but the water, and so the traveler jogged along in the middle of the road, lonesome and dreary enough. If any bagman of that day could have caught sight of the little neck-or-nothing sort of gig, with a clay-colored body and red wheels, and the vixenish, ill-tempered, fast-going bay mare that looked like a cross between a butcher's horse and a twopenny post office pony, he would have known at once that this traveler could have been no other than Tom Smart, of the great house of Bilson and Slum, Caddington Street, City. However, as there was no bagman to look on, nobody knew anything at all about the matter, and so Tom Smart and his clay-colored gig with the red wheels, and the vixenish mare with the fast pace, went on together, keeping the secret among them, and nobody was a bit the wiser. There are many pleasanter places even in this dreary world than Marlborough Downs when it blows hard. And if you throw in beside, a gloomy winter's evening, a miry and sloppy road, and a pelting fall of heavy rain, and try the effect, by way of experiment, in your own proper person, you will experience the full force of this observation. The wind blew not up the road or down it, though that's bad enough, but sheer across it, sending the rain slanting down like the lines they used to rule in the copy books at school, to make the boys slope well. For a moment it would die away, and the traveler would begin to delude himself into the belief that, exhausted with its previous fury, it had quietly laid itself down to rest, when, woo, he could hear it growling and whistling in the distance, and on it would come rushing over the hilltops, and sweeping along the plain, gathering sound and strength as it drew nearer, until it dashed with a heavy gust against horse and man, driving the sharp rain into their ears, and its cold damp breath into their very bones, and past them it would scour, far, far away, with a stunning roar, as if in ridicule of their weakness, and triumphant in the consciousness of its own strength and power. The bay mare splashed away, through the mud and water, with drooping ears, now and then tossing her head, as if to express her disgust at this very ungentlemanly behavior of the elements, but keeping a good pace notwithstanding, until a gust of wind, more furious than any that had yet assailed them, caused her to stop suddenly, and plant her 4 feet firmly against the ground, to prevent her being blown over. It's a special mercy that she did this, for if she had been blown over, the vixenish mare was so light, and the gig was so light, and Tom Smart such a lightweight into the bargain, that they must infallibly have all gone rolling over and over together, until they reached the confines of earth, or until the wind fell, and in either case the probability is, that neither the vixenish mare, nor the clay-colored gig with the red wheels, nor Tom Smart, would ever have been fit for service again. Well, damn my straps and whiskers, says Tom Smart. Tom sometimes had an unpleasant knack of swearing. Damn my straps and whiskers, says Tom, if this ain't pleasant, blow me. You'll very likely ask me why, as Tom Smart had been pretty well blown already, he expressed this wish to be submitted to the same process again. I can't say. All I know is, that Tom Smart said so, or at least he always told my uncle he said so, and it's just the same thing. Blow me, says Tom Smart, and the mare neighed, as if she were precisely of the same opinion. Cheer up, old girl, said Tom, patting the bay mare on the neck with the end of his whip. It won't do pushing on, such a night as this. The first house we come to we'll put up at, so the faster you go the sooner it's over. So old girl, gently, gently. Whether the vixenish mare was sufficiently well acquainted with the tones of Tom's voice to comprehend his meaning, or whether she found it colder standing still than moving on, of course I can't say. But I can say that Tom had no sooner finished speaking, than she pricked up her ears, and started forward at a speed which made the clay-colored gig rattle until you would have supposed every one of the red spokes were going to fly out on the turf of Marlborough Downs, and even Tom, whip as he was, couldn't stop or check her pace, until she drew up of her own accord, before a roadside inn on the right-hand side of the way, about half a quarter of a mile from the end of the downs. Tom cast a hasty glance at the upper part of the house as he threw the reins to the hostler, and stuck the whip in the box. It was a strange old place, built of a kind of shingle, inlaid, as it were, with cross beams, with gable-topped windows projecting completely over the pathway, and a low door with a dark porch, and a couple of steep steps leading down into the house, instead of the modern fashion of half a dozen shallow ones leading up to it. It was a comfortable-looking place, though, for there was a strong, cheerful light in the bar window, which shed a bright ray across the road, and even lighted up the hedge on the other side. And there was a red flickering light in the opposite window, one moment but faintly discernible, and the next gleaming strongly through the drawn curtains, which intimated that a rousing fire was blazing within. Marking these little evidences with the eye of an experienced traveler, Tom dismounted with as much agility as his half-frozen limbs would permit, and entered the house. In less than 5 minutes' time, Tom was ensconced in the room opposite the bar, the very room where he had imagined the fire blazing before, a substantial, matter-of-fact, roaring fire, composed of something short of a bushel of coals, and wood enough to make half a dozen decent gooseberry bushes, piled halfway up the chimney, and roaring and crackling with a sound that of itself would have warmed the heart of any reasonable man. This was comfortable, but this was not all, for a smartly dressed girl, with a bright eye and a neat ankle, was laying a very clean white cloth on the table, and as Tom sat with his slippered feet on the fender, and his back to the open door, he saw a charming prospect of the bar reflected in the glass over the chimney piece, with delightful rows of green bottles and gold labels, together with jars of pickles and preserves, and cheeses and boiled hams, and rounds of beef, arranged on shelves, in the most tempting and delicious array. Well, this was comfortable too. But even this was not all, for in the bar, seated at tea at the nicest possible little table, drawn close up before the brightest possible little fire, was a buxom widow of somewhere about 8-and-40 or thereabouts, with a face as comfortable as the bar, who was evidently the landlady of the house, and the supreme ruler over all these agreeable possessions. There was only one drawback to the beauty of the whole picture, and that was a tall man, a very tall man in a brown coat and bright Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.